Deadcast.
July 12th, 1997. A 19-year-old African-American man named David Mitchell is hitchhiking along the side of the road near St. Charles Parish, Louisiana. David has just left a family member's house where a birthday party was taking place. He's trying to get back home to his grandmother's. As he stands there, thumb held out, trying to catch someone's attention, David has no idea that a predator lurks among the cars that go whizzing by. When the pickup truck pulls up alongside of him, he goes to the passenger side window, explaining to the man where it is that he is heading. The driver, a short, heavy-set man with thinning brown hair and a goatee, readily agrees to give him a ride. David takes a quick glance around the cab of the truck, noting the cane that sits between the two of them. "This man is no danger to me," David thinks as he climbs inside. The truck quickly speeds off into the growing gloom. Its passenger, David, unaware that he will never reach his destination. On July 14th, a body is found inside of a drainage ditch along a highway near St. Charles Parish. When police arrive, they find the youth, a young black man, lying face down in the brackish water. When an autopsy is performed, it is found that the young man has water from the drainage ditch inside of his lungs. The young man's father refuses to believe that his son had drowned in the ditch. What no one, not David's father, the police, or members of the local communities could know, is that he was the first of many victims of a man the FBI has dubbed the most significant case of serial murder in the last two decades. This is the story of the Baton Rouge Strangler, and this is the Deathcast. Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to look into the case of Ronald Dominique, the Baton Rouge Strangler. Before we get into this week's story, however, I have a few show notes and plugs. If you would like to follow me on social media, that would be Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and MeWe. Just search for Ian Totten, author. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, just search out Corpse Creek Publishing. If you would like to help the show with its production, go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com. Click on the donate button. Buy me a cup of coffee, or just say thanks for all the work that you put in. Again, that's CorpseCreekPublishing.com. While there, please consider signing up for the mailing list and check out the various products that I have for sale there. There's a link to the 5 novels that I have released on Amazon. The Blood Gods Trilogy, The House of Silver Doors, and my most recent and best-selling release, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, which will be coming out on audiobook through Audible here in the near future. If you really enjoy the show, you want to see it grow, please consider going to your favorite podcast app, whether it be Podcast Addict or Apple Podcasts, and leaving us 5-star review. They really do help with the show. I think we have 10 reviews on Apple Podcasts at this point. Most of them good, some of them bad. To those people who don't like it, fuck you. To those who do enjoy the show, however, I want to send a big thank you, because you guys are helping this show grow by leaps and bounds, and I'm going to explain what I mean by that. I recently signed up with an industry-leading metrics company to kind of track how the show is actually doing. I can see, really, you know, how many downloads I get, how many downloads by website, yada, yada, yada. But I really couldn't see much else until I signed up with this metric score and discovered, much to my surprise, that the Deathcast has consistently been ranked within the top 500 true crime podcasts in the world across all platforms. Now, some people don't see that as a big deal. To me, that's a huge fucking deal. There are thousands upon thousands of podcasts out there that deal with true crime, and to think that my little small rinky-dink homemade podcast is reaching that many people, that it would be ranked within the top 500, is mind-blowing. But even more mind-blowing to me is the fact that the Deathcast is actually ranked within the top 500 of true crime podcasts in the United States. In fact, the last I checked, which was a few days ago, we were set at number 418. So, to everyone who listens to the show, subscribes to it, shares it on social media, and tells other people about it, I want to give my sincerest thanks. Because I don't make any money from this show. In fact, I spend money every month in order to make sure that the show can get out to you, because these hosting platforms don't just allow you to post your podcasts for free. If you want to go to other websites such as Apple Podcasts and Podbeam, you have to pay a subscription fee. So the idea that this little show may possibly be getting big enough that I might actually be able to afford some sponsorship to help offset the costs of this show is truly humbling. And the people responsible for this mostly know who they are. I've talked about them before on this show. My peeps and freaks over at Murder, Mayhem, and Crime Whores, a group that's on Facebook as well as on MeWe. We're hardcore true crime fiends in that group. I'm not talking the kind of stuff you're going to find on Oxygen or the ID channel. The people in this group really get into true crime. We're not adverse to looking at the crime scene photographs unedited. You're not going to see much in the group about, you know, cases that are currently trending. But if you're really into true crime, search out Murder, Mayhem, and Crime Whores, also going under the name of Dead Inside. There are a bunch of good people in there. Brooke, Steve, Tiffany, a whole host of them who have continued to help this show grow, but also give me ideas for shows. Alright, now that the plugs are out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy seat, sit back, relax, I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes, let's go into the crypt. As you heard from the trailer, today we're going to be looking at the life and crimes of Ronald Dominique, the man dubbed the Baton Rouge Strangler. Now, his first known victim was a 19-year-old by the name of David LaVon Mitchell Jr. Now, David went missing July 12th of 1997, and he was found 2 days later on July 14th. Prior to going missing, David had been at a birthday party with his mother, Latrice Mitchell, his grandmother, and an aunt. I've looked and tried to find who it was exactly that found David's body. Some sources state that it was a passerby on this stretch of highway outside of St. Charles Parish. Others that the police are the actual individuals who came across him. The area he was found is actually called River Road, and in the many parts of the South, you have these two-lane highways. When most people think of a highway, they're picturing, you know, four-lane blacktop that runs along both sides. But especially in areas like this, you have what are called two-lane highways. He was found in St. Charles Parish, which, from my understanding of Louisiana, just means that it, you know, it was really a county. He was actually found in an area called Hanville. And when police found David, there were no signs of assault, although they did note that his pants had been pulled down around his ankles. And when the autopsy was performed on his body, it was found that he had water inside of his lungs from the drainage ditch that he had been found in. Obviously, his parents found out all of this information and immediately began to suspect that their son had not, in fact, drowned, but was the victim of foul play. And the police looked into his movements that night. They found that David had been at this party, and he had been brought there by his aunt. And when the party was over, he told his aunt that he was going to wait for his uncle to arrive so that he could catch a ride back to his grandmother's house. And according to family members, the uncle never arrived, and it appeared as though David had hitchhiked after that point. The family initially thought that he might have gone over to a friend's house when they didn't hear from him over, you know, the next few days, which is consistent when you consider the fact that he was a 19-year-old male and really not beholden to anyone as far as letting them know where it is that he was at. They really didn't know anything was wrong until the 14th, which was a Monday, when David's supervisor at the St. Charles Parish Hospital called and informed his mother that he had not shown up for work. After checking David's room, it was found that his badge for work, as well as his work clothes, were inside of his bedroom, which immediately sent off alarm bells in the family's heads, as David wasn't the type of kid who would miss a day of work, nor was he the type of person who would go out for days on end without informing his family eventually of where he was. He might go and spend the night at a friend's house, but he would always contact them eventually to let them know where he was at. Eventually, rumors began to reach the family that a black man's body had been found out on River Road inside of a drainage ditch. Obviously, the family began to fear the worst and, you know, were praying that it wasn't their son that was found. But eventually, the police did show up at the family's house to inform them that they had found David's body in this ditch. And David's mother was so overcome with grief that she was unable to go down to the coroner's office to view the body. So his father and aunt went down instead. And it was there that they learned that he had water in his lungs and that they suspected that he had drowned in the drainage ditch. It should be noted that according to David's family, he was a very intelligent young man. He was a honor roll student in high school. He was also a newspaper reporter for the local paper in his high school. And when the police began to talk about drugs possibly being involved in their son's death, the family immediately rebelled against this idea, as that just wasn't David. Years later, when his death was finally solved, the family would rebel again when the police came out and stated that the man responsible chose victims who led dangerous lifestyles and hitchhiked often. Again, that was not the David that his family knew, and I suspect that they are more likely than not. I believe that he probably just got into the car with someone who was disarming, and that that individual, you know, used both his size and personality to relax him enough that he was able to get him to a place where he was able to assault him. But at the time of David's murder, the police were still operating under the assumption that, you know, he had died a death by misadventure, even though the family steadfast refused to believe it and pushed them to continue looking into the case. From all appearances, it seems as though David's case went cold after that. In December of 1997, a 20-year-old black male by the name of Gary Pierce was found in a wooded area in Mons. Pierce was a known drug user and had actually recently been released from jail following a drug-related arrest. He was fully clothed and there was no signs of any sort of physical trauma or assault. Initially, his death was left unclassified as the police could not find any sort of cause, whether it was accidental, intentional, or natural. Again, this case went cold. On July 31st of 1998, a 38-year-old man by the name of Larry Ranson, who was known to be addicted to narcotics as well as homeless, was found lying alongside Louisiana Highway 3160 near Hanville. He had been strangled, and it was apparent to the investigating officers that some form of trauma had in fact taken place with him. It should be noted at this point that there were a few other deaths that took place during this period of time, which have never been officially linked to the Baton Rouge Strangler. However, they fit within the parameters of Dominique's known victims in that they were known to be drug addicts, they were African American, and they were found in places that they should not have been. That's just speculation on my part as to whether or not they were actual victims of his or not. And this comes up again and again throughout the course of this story where bodies are found, they're later linked to this individual, but the bodies of other young men which are found are not linked to him, despite obvious similarities in both their lifestyles as well as the disposal of their remains. In October of 1998, a 27-year-old man by the name of Oliver LeBanks, a known drug addict with possible connections to male prostitution, was found outside of Metairie. For all my friends in the BTT Army, we've heard stories about what a wonderfully unique place Metairie, Louisiana is. Anyway, his body was found on October 4th in a wooded area, and upon examination of the body, it was found that Oliver had recently had sexual relations and had been beaten and strangled. Family members of Oliver stated that he was a former drug addict who had begun living on the streets after returning to using drug use and being fired from his job. And over the course of the next few months, roughly October of 98 to August of 99, the man who was responsible for these crimes really started to pick up his activities insofar as his killing. And you see this a lot of times with various criminals who are serial killers. They go through a period where they start off slow killing, and, you know, there's that cooling off period after the murder of, you know, a few days to a few months to possibly even a year, where they ingest what they've done, they revel in the fact that they haven't gotten away with it, they relive that crime over and over again in their heads before finding another victim and going through it again. And eventually, they reach a point where the cooling off periods start to shrink dramatically in between the crimes. Going from, you know, 5 or 6 months in between crimes to maybe a couple of weeks or a couple of days, sometimes a month or two in between. And that's the case with this particular killer. He committed crimes at first, then had this long cooling off period, or at least we suspect he did. But then once he started to get his groove and become comfortable with what it was that he was doing, his homicides started to get shorter and shorter. I mean, by that, I mean the periods in between them. And to give you an idea of this, in the same month that Oliver LeBlanc went missing, that'd be October of 1998, a 16-year-old by the name of Joseph Brown met a man inside of a pickup truck in Kenner, Louisiana, and the man asked him to get into the truck with him because he wanted to buy crack cocaine. And supposedly, so the story goes, after they smoked crack together, the driver of the truck attacked Brown, beating him, sexually assaulting him, before strangling him to death by placing a plastic bag over his head. When the police found the young boy's body, he was instantly recognizable to them, as Brown had recently been placed onto probation for a drug-related offense. Now, Dominique didn't waste any time in going after his next victim. In fact, a month later, in November of 1998, he struck again, this time targeting 18-year-old Bruce Williams, who had a similar background as a number of the other victims did. That is, he had a history of drug abuse problems. I personally think it speaks to the amount of violent crimes in this area of Louisiana, this southeastern portion of it, that it would be many, many, many years before a task force was set up to look into these particular homicides. Because the police pretty much looked at each case as having no connection to the other, despite the similarities in the MOs, the victim profiles, the manner of death, the manner where the bodies were left. Dominique continued on with his killing ways. In May of 1999, he was driving around Kenner when he spotted a 21-year-old by the name of Manuel Reed, who apparently offered to sell Dominique drugs. Dominique accepted the offer, getting him inside of his vehicle, where he apparently raped the young man before strangling him to death, after which he dumped his body inside of a dumpster not far from where the body of Brown was found. And this particular part is odd to me, in that if you see pictures of the individual who's eventually convicted of these crimes, he does not look like someone who could physically overpower another individual, particularly not a young, strong male, but apparently, at least at this point during his career, he was in fact able to do so. And do it very successfully, because like a lot of other serial killers, Ronald hunted along the fringes of society. The drug addicts, the homeless, the members of the gay community who might have been shunned by others within it. So he really flew underneath the radar of the police, who I'm sure were looking at this as just another junkie who died. Unlike a number of other cases, the murder of Manuel Reed had traces of semen found on the body, and up until this point, the only other body that had had semen traces on it was LeBanks. Some people have looked at this case and wondered why the police weren't immediately able to link these two crimes together based on the semen evidence. Again, you have to remember that A, these individuals were from the dregs of society, but we also were not living in the period of time in the late 90s where DNA and forensic evidence was the be-all de facto way to solve a crime. DNA evidence was still pretty much in its infancy. So while they might have been able to find that they came from a similar type source, they would not have been able to definitively say, oh, it came from a person from this background, you know, a white male, this age group, yada, yada, yada. They were not that advanced with DNA evidence testing techniques at that point. They did, however, have the foresight to save these semen samples that were found. In June of 1999, a 21-year-old named Angela Mejia, who was known to be homeless and also a drug addict, was killed. When Mejia's body was discovered, it was actually lying out in the middle of the street. And it would later be learned that the killer had attempted to dispose of him inside of a dumpster, but upon finding that the dumpster was full, the body was simply just dropped where he was. The coroner later determined that Mejia had recently ingested drugs, but that also he had been tied up with ropes just prior to his demise. Now, this particular murder led police to look into the others that they had on their hands at this point around Kenner, and it was because of looking into their backgrounds that it discovered that Mejia, Brown, and Pierre all knew one another and lived within close proximity to each other. At some point in August of 1999, a convicted drug addict by the name of Mitchell Johnson went missing. And when his body was found in a forest just outside of Metairie on September 1st, officers first noted that he was completely naked and that he had been tied up by his killer. They also noted considerable bruising to the body, and they suspected that Mitchell had been raped. It doesn't appear that there were any more victims for the remainder of 1999. However, in January of 2000, a 23-year-old by the name of Michael Vincent went missing in La Froche Parish. In October of 2000, a 3-time convicted child predator by the name of Kenneth Randall Jr., age 20, was found naked in a field in Houma, Louisiana. This one I can't say I'm actually surprised with. My wrestling peeps have heard stories about Houma, Louisiana. But for those of you who do not know about Houma, it is a fairly financially depressed city with a very, very high crime rate. And at least according to some people who have spent time in the city, the people who live there almost seem to have this innate bloodlust within them. There's stories dating back to the 60s, 70s, and 80s of full-scale riots breaking out at professional wrestling matches, with fans bringing squirt guns filled with bleach and drain cleaner, straight razors, knives, and guns. So the idea that a convicted child molester was found dead inside of a field, I can understand why the police did not initially link this man's murder to the string of serial murders that had been taking place. And I'm sorry, but I'm really not sorry that this particular piece of trash ended up getting murdered, because anyone who has been listening to the show for a while knows what I think of child sexual predators. So, in this particular case, fuck that guy. Doesn't appear that there are any murders that were linked to Dominique for the next year to 2 years. However, in 2002, a 26-year-old by the name of Anoka Jones, a petty criminal living in Houma, ended up meeting a man driving a pickup truck. His body was found a few hours later underneath an overpass. Also in 2002, the body of a 19-year-old named Detrell Woods was found along with his bicycle in a field outside of Bayou Blue, which is an unincorporated community which is not far from Houma. When the police found Woods' body, they noted that it was in an advanced state of decomposition and that he was partially naked. This was in May of 2003 that he was found, so some months later. And while it was determined that he had died from asphyxiation, initially it was believed that he had done it to himself. The reason given for this was that Woods was known to suffer from asthma. It's kind of amazing to me that at this point police had not pieced together that they had a serial killer on their hands. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, we're talking a fairly large geographical area which these killings were taking place in, the idea that nobody had the wherewithal to look at it and go, hey, you know what, a lot of these murders are hitting the same kind of people and they're dying the same way, being found in similar areas, maybe we should look into this. No, instead, the police would look into each individual case and then either decide that the individual who had died had in some fashion caused their own death, or that someone had murdered them but they didn't know who, or lastly, that the cause of death was unable to be determined. In October of 2004, a 46-year-old drug addict and dealer by the name of Larry Matthews went missing. And when he went missing, nobody reported it because Matthews was, like so many of these victims, homeless. And when his body was eventually found, 20 miles away from his last known whereabouts, they actually had to use fingerprints in an effort to identify him. And it was at this point that Dominique switched up his modus operandi. Up until this period in time, he had been specifically targeting black males. With his next victim, however, he shifted his focus to white men, which, coincidentally, is when the police actually began to seriously consider the fact that these crimes were related. And before I get a bunch of bullshit emails from people with the white man evil, they only looked into them because they were white. Fuck you. The reason that they didn't start freaking connecting all of these crimes has nothing to do with the race of the victims, but the fact that at this point in Louisiana, there were multiple serial killers operating, two of them with very similar modus operandi, which is to say that the police were unable at this period of time to differentiate between who was killing which victims. This particular victim was a 21-year-old by the name of Michael Barnett, whose body was found on October 24, 2004. The next murder victim was a 21-year-old alcoholic who was described as bombastic in personality, meaning that he could fly off the handle at any period of time. He was a 22-year-old by the name of Leon Lorette, who went missing, and coincidentally, he had known the previous victim, Michael Barnett, as well as another victim by the name of Anoka Jones. Leon had lived with both men, and initially, Leon was the prime suspect in Jones's murder, as he was the last person known to have seen Jones alive prior to their disappearance. In April of 2005, a 31-year-old by the name of August Watkins, who again was homeless, went missing. There's a number of different reports on what actually happened during this particular murder, as well as what came afterwards, but the general consensus is that he, being Watkins, was lured into Dominic's truck with the promise of an overnight stay. Once back at Dominique's trailer, Watkins was given alcohol and offered the opportunity to have sex with a female acquaintance before being tied up, raped, and strangled. Some reports have it that after Watkins' body was found, that this is when the police actually began to seriously suspect that a serial killer was on the loose, although some of the court documents that I have read actually state that it was prior to this particular murder, in fact, two murders beforehand when Barnett's body was found is when they started really looking into the fact. But it wasn't until April of 2005 that they actually formed a task force among the six parishes in this area of Louisiana to look into who it was that might actually be committing these crimes. Over the next few months, three more young men would go missing, with one of them, Alonzo Hogan, being killed in St. Charles Parish and being raped by his assailant post-mortem. Something that hampered detectives being able to actually find the man responsible for these murders especially at this time when they were really looking into who might be responsible, was the fact that Hurricane Katrina hit in late August of 2005. For those of you who may not remember, this is the one that made the levees in Louisiana break and flooded the city. We had people living inside of the Superdome in an effort to, you know, stay out of the storm's wrath. And afterwards, there was a whole big exodus of people from the area into Texas while the government attempted to rebuild the area. Katrina didn't just hit New Orleans, it hit all of the parishes in that area, causing massive damage, and helped Dominique stay under the radar of the police as he continued his killing spree, with his next victim being a 40-year-old by the name of Chris DeVille, who was trying to get out of Napoleonville to go to an area that had not been affected by the storm. DeVille's body was one of the worst when investigators found it inside of a reed field, as animals had been at it, specifically rats and mice. So when they found the body, it had been severely destroyed by animal predation. In November, another victim was claimed, that of 21-year-old Nicholas Pellegrin in La Forcha Parish. Police were initially led off the case on this one, as Nicholas's family informed the officers that shortly before his death, he had borrowed $400 in order to pay off drug dealers, and that he was fearing for his life, as he had missed a payment to them and had begun receiving death threats. The last known victim of Dominique was 27-year-old Christopher Sutterfield. His last known whereabouts were in a Iberfield Parish Park. When police found his body, he had been extensively tortured, subjected to bondage, and had apparently been struck over the head with some form of blunt instrument. Talking to Sutterfield's relatives and acquaintances, they all said the same thing. Sutterfield was last seen driving inside of a black SUV with an unidentified white male. In November of 2006, a man by the name of Ronald Dominique was reported to the police after a man by the name of Ricky Wallace contacted them in Bayou Blue. Wallace stated that Dominique had attempted to lure him to his trailer in mid-2006 with an offer to share drugs, after which they would have sex with a girl that Dominique would provide. When Wallace entered the trailer, Ronald tried to convince him that his girlfriend enjoyed bondage and offered to tie Wallace up. Wallace refused, and soon after, he was allowed to leave. Now, something about this encounter led Wallace to suspect that something was really wrong with Ronald, so much so that he contacted the police, and when the police came and took Ronald in for questioning, they asked him to provide a blood sample, which he readily agreed to do. However, that's the official story. The reality is the police had been watching Ronald off and on for at least a few months prior to Wallace contacting them. And the reason for this is because Ronald had a history of sexual abuse going back to at least 1996. when the police checked Ronald's DNA, they found that it matched the man that they were looking for. As, if you'll recall, semen had been left on the bodies of Oliver LeBlancs and Emmanuel Reed. And an arrest warrant was quickly drawn up. On December 1st, 2006, Ronald was arrested at a homeless shelter. Supposedly, upon his arrest, Ronald told police that he had moved out of his sister's house in Bayou Blue because he knew it was only a matter of time before he was captured and he did not want to inconvenience her. So, who is Ronald Dominique? Ronald Joseph Dominique was born on January 9th, 1964 in the Badoaks, Louisiana. He was the youngest of two children born into a poor, lower-class family. The family lived in a trailer park just outside of the city. While in school, Dominique was known to have a melancholy temperament. He lacked communication skills and suffered from weight problems and various health issues. It was said later that he was the frequent target of bullies due to both his family's financial status as well as the fact that he was short and obese. Supposedly, during his senior year, Ronald discovered that he was gay and went and visited a gay bar, although this has been disputed as having never happened. Regardless, some classmates have stated that it did in fact happen, and then when they learned that he had been seen there by other classmates, they taunted and harassed him over this, which, given the time period of the early 1980s, specifically 1983, is not too far outside of the realm of possibility. After graduating, Ronald entered the Nicholls State University, where he studied computer science, although he dropped out of school when he lost interest. Throughout most of his life, Ronald held menial jobs and pretty much lived in almost complete abject poverty, bouncing between his parents' trailer and that of his sister's. He was noted around his neighborhoods as being a fairly friendly individual who would not hesitate to help his neighbors. But there was another side to Ronald, as he was known to frequent gay bars in the area, but not only to frequent the gay bars, but to do so well in drag. Another moniker I have come across for him is the Patti LaBelle Killer, as Ronald would often go to these bars dressed as his favorite singer. And it was from one of these bars that Ronald first came to the attention of police. Apparently, he met a male at one of these bars in 1985, and when things did not work out between the two men, Ronald turned around and called the man on the phone, sexually harassing him, so much so that the police were eventually called and he was arrested for this. Ronald ended up pleading guilty to this crime and ended up paying a $74 fine as well as court costs. After this, he continued to bounce around in between living with his sister and his parents while working menial jobs and spending his nights out at the gay bars. On May 15, 1994, he was arrested and charged with driving while intoxicated and speeding. This next arrest is really the one that sparked his killing spree. On August 25, 1996, he was arrested on forcible rape charges and booked on a $100,000 bond. From what witnesses said, a partially dressed young man had escaped from the window of Dominique's house in Thibodeaux, screaming that Ronald had tried to kill him. However, when the case went to trial, the victim was unable to be found, and the judge continued the case indefinitely. My thought on this particular crime is that Ronald either killed the young man or the victim decided to get out of the area fearful of what might happen should Ronald find out his location. What cannot be disputed, however, is that Ronald himself later stated to investigators that he in fact began killing after this crime because he did not want to leave any witnesses and he did not want to go back to prison. And I'm going to get into what exactly it is that Ronald would do shortly after I get done going over his rap sheet. In May of 2000, he received a summons to appear in court on disturbing the peace charges, which Ronald was able to avoid jail time of because the crime was a misdemeanor and he simply ended up paying court costs and a small fine. On February 10th, 2002, Ronald was arrested once more after assaulting a woman at a Mardi Gras festival in Tierborn Parish. According to Ronald, the woman had struck a baby stroller as she drove through a parking lot, and he began to argue with her, citing how dangerous her driving was, forcing the woman to apologize. Now, sources differ as to what happened. Some state that Ronald slapped the woman across the face after she apologized, with other sources stating that he full-on punched her in the face. Regardless of which is true, the charges ended up being dropped, and Ronald's case was dismissed, allowing him to go on with his murderous ways. Okay, so what happened with Ronald? After he was brought into police custody, he claimed that he was willing to cooperate with investigators. This due to the constant surveillance that he had been under due to their suspicions of his activities. What the police were not ready for, however, was the amount of victims Ronald claimed. They knew he had murdered at least 2 to 3 victims, but Ronald went on to confess to a total of at least 23 murders committed between 1997 and his arrest in 2006. That is a very large number, made bigger by the fact that the police were able to corroborate most of these particular crimes. One detective in Louisiana stated that Ronald Dominique was the John Wayne Gacy of southeastern Louisiana, which is really not far from the truth, especially when you find out how he operated. Ronald would go to the areas where he knew drug addicts operated at. And more often than not, the individuals that he targeted were homeless individuals who would really do anything for money. So his basic MO was to get them to come over to the truck and to talk to them, at which point he would offer them money for sex. And once he got them in his truck, he would drive them back to his trailer and, you know, ply them with alcohol, after which point he would talk about how he enjoyed bondage and ask them if they minded being tied up. If, according to Ronald, though, they consented to being tied up, he would tie them up, at which point he would sexually assault, beat, and then murder them, by strangulation. However, if they did not consent to being tied up, he would let the individuals go. Another MO was that he would tell them that he wanted to buy drugs from them, get them into the vehicle, do the drugs with the victim, at which point he would strike. Other methods that Ronald used involved convincing the individual that they were going to go back to his trailer and party, at which point he had a girl who was willing to have sex with the both of them. And then when he got them back to the trailer, he would inform the intended victim that the girl that they were going to have sex with preferred to have the victim tied up for bondage. Again, if they consented, Ronald tied them up and continued with his MO. If not, he would allegedly release them. The last MO concerned the child molester who was found outside of HOMA, the one that I had stated I was not sorry to see die. Apparently, this man was a neighbor of Ronald's, and the two of them kind of hit it off, until Ronald learned that the man was into children, and the man began to express to him how much he really wanted to find another girl to have sex with. Supposedly, this struck a chord with Ronald, who decided that the man needed to die. So he invited the man over to his trailer with the promise that he had a young girl lined up for them to have sex with. Now, once at the trailer, Ronald plied the man with drugs and alcohol before tying the man up, raping, beating, and murdering him. And this is all stuff that Ronald admitted to the police. And you should keep that in your mind, because serial killers are notorious liars, and while he admitted to 23 murders, it is suspected that he killed many, many more men than he was eventually convicted of. And he was convicted. In 2008, Ronald admitted his guilt in 23 homicides and received numerous life sentences without the possibility of parole. Personally, I think that given the length of time that he was out hunting, you know, his kill count may be as high as the 60s or 70s. Because really, the crimes that he was convicted of are the ones that police presented to him and that they were looking into as being possibly the work of a serial killer. Now again, there were at least two other serial killers operating in the Baton Rouge area at this time, one of which was Derek Todd Lee, who targeted predominantly white women. The other is a man who is going to be next week's subject, because yes, we are staying in the Baton Rouge area for episode 50, as a man by the name of Sean Gillis, who murdered and mutilated at least 18 women in the Baton Rouge area. As for me, I'm left with a couple of questions concerning this case. If, as Ronald stated, he took the majority of victims back to his home, how is it that no one in his family was aware of his activities? That's being specific to his mother and sister, both of whom he lived with in trailers. Trailers aren't that big if he was doing this type of stuff inside of the house, and they were home. They had to have known what was going on. Another question I have is, given the fact that he was targeting only men, is there another serial killer active in Baton Rouge who was targeting men at this same period of time that the police just have not caught yet? because by their own statements, Ronald's killing were kind of lost in among the shuffle with the other two killers who were active at that point. However, we know those other two murderers were only targeting women. So, if that's the case, then there has to be another killer or killers in this specific area that were going after men and disposing of them in a similar manner, but the police just have not talked about it as of yet. That is it for the Deathcast this week. Again, I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I would like to thank you once again for joining me. I look forward to seeing you back here next week for our next case in the Baton Rouge trilogy. Again, you can find me on all social media. If you'd like to help support the show and possibly sign up for our mailing list, go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com, click sign up for the mailing list, enter your info, and click the donate button. Buy me a cup of coffee. Until next week, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.